it's a great pleasure to be here, and I'd like to thank the organizers again. It's a really great program. Certainly for me, it's a golden opportunity to catch up with what my old friends have been doing. It's in the 80s that we sort of departed. I went the way of non-equilibrium statistical mechanics, thinking that it might have something to do with quantum gravity. And of course, the braver ones, and they march on, and I think they now have the truth. And so it's good to see where we stand. Also, of course, in the program, there are quite a few talks, which I enjoy a lot, covering the broader perspective of quantum gravity. So, some thoughts. I'm actually referring to specifically the micro-macro and the quantum classical interfaces. The issues are non-locality and stochasticity. You might wonder why I pull out these two issues and why these interfaces, or how are they related to quantum gravity. Before doing that, I need to give a whole set of apologies. First of all, unlike most other talks, this one focuses on ideas. Very little mathematics in this talk, so it's not even imprecise, okay? Not even wrong, certainly not even imprecise. And many ideas you'll find familiar or commonplace. And you might find this talk, therefore, completely irrelevant to what you're doing. Those are the apologies. So it's familiar, it's irrelevant, or out of place, and that reminded me when I was writing this slide yesterday of Marcel Duchamp's fountain. Okay, it's certainly out of place. But that actually is my starting point. Okay, the familiar and irrelevant, usually we throw them in the garbage can, call it noise. And out of place is certainly sort of non-local. And it's one of the purposes of this talk is to ask whether we have overlooked something elementary yet important. So here's quantum gravity. I place it this way because quantum, I guess this is something that we can all agree. We learned quantum from atomic physics, which is micro. And of course that developed to quantum field theory. And we learn gravity, of course, in the context of general relativity as applied to the universe and so on. And that certainly describes the classical macroscopic world, the space-time concept and so on. And of course, I mean, there's the struggle between these two theories that have bothered us quite a while. Now, what is quantum gravity? I've been raising this question once more. And in fact, incidentally, I hope those speakers, when I ask questions, you don't take it to mean sort of negatively. I really want to understand some of the things. Like, this is another naive question. So when I thought about it, maybe there is something that we could agree in common, a theory of the microscopic structure of space-time. Yes? Okay. But then right next to that, we probably would find disagreement. It's not necessarily, if you quantize the general relativity, it may not lead to a microscopic structure of space-time. I know this is the worst place to say such a thing, but I'll say it anyway. Now, if it is, like electromagnetism, we just quantize the connection form, and then we get, of course, QED. If that were the case for gravity, then we're lucky and we should be happy. That sometimes I feel is the tone. That is, this program is completed. Now we only need to look at the implications. Well, unfortunately, I'm dwelling on the unhappy situation, and sorry for that. Just in case this is the true, how are we going to deal with it? So if we assume that, well, quantizing macro variables may not give microstructures, so this is something that I like to explore further. Now, cases which work, the electromagnetism, as I just mentioned, going to QED, and the micro and macro variables are the same. It's, of course, this is the electromagnetic theory, it's a linear theory. And we can also see it in helium-4. It's a nicely behaved, you know, sort of fluid, superfluid. But mind you, there's also a helium-3 which behaves completely differently. Okay, so to get to the macroscopic collective behavior, you really need to get down to the atomic level. Now, so let me just present this sort of perspective here. Suppose I haven't learned, you know, PowerPoint well enough to make these boxes and so on, and that's my arrow there. So if we look at quantum and classical, and then micro and macro in these two axes, let's say, traditionally, we would say that we go from classical, try to quantize it, and that would give us the micro theory, microscopic structure of spacetime. Of course, we know at the same time that classical macroscopic structure, of course, is very well described by general relativity theory. So what I'm posing, okay, it could be a completely sort of trivial or frivolous thing to many people. That's why I have to apologize for dragging you through this hour. What I'm suggesting is that it could be that there is actually a wide, you know, another dimension that prompts us to ask the question of how to go from macro to micro. Okay, and that is the task that I've taken upon myself to try to understand how to go about doing that. As I said, I mean, if it turns out that quantizing it, the classical variables will give us the quantum, or will give us a theory of the microscopic structure of space-time, I'll be the first one to give all of you a bottle of champagne. Now, looking at this, you see that quantum going to classical, of course, has occupied our attention in the last 15 years, or of course longer for the philosophers. But now, you know, through decoherence, one has gained some knowledge of how that comes about. In fact, it's really a very important factor in the discussion, in the quantum computing community. Now, I'm more interested in the vertical direction. That is, first of all, I'd like to understand how we get a macro from a micro. Okay? And I think that is an issue that may not seem so trivial, okay? And of course, with it, coarse graining and emergent entities, for example, space-time, how does that come out from some of the microscopic constituents? And the next slide I'll show you. And on this side, even at the classical level, never mind about quantum altogether, you can see how the classical molecular dynamics is one very simple example, how you go from molecular dynamics to hydrodynamics. And that's why non-equilibrium statistical mechanics really comes in essential for this quest of trying to go from macro to micro. I'll also convince you, well, let me mention these issues here. This slide and most of these things were prepared a long time ago. And along the direction of non-equilibrium statistical mechanics and stochastic mechanics, these are the key issues, really, that one needs to deal with. Coherence, quantum coherence, correlation, quantum correlation, fluctuations, thermal and quantum, and stochasticity. At a different level, and I'll explain that with another slide, why I, you know, pull out these as the key issues. Collectivity. How do you find a collective variable to describe macroscopic phenomena if the, you know, the microscopic variables are not directly extendable to the macro variables? And this variability, I'll explain that also in the context of coarse graining, decoherence and the emergence of semi-classical domain, for example. And non-linearity, and finally non-locality. So in this talk, I'm just focusing on these two issues, but this is the backdrop. So top-down or bottom-up, this has been mentioned several times. The brave ones go to the mountains and bring back the truth. And I'll tell you also, they need a little bit of statistical mechanics to show people sort of living in the valley what truth really means to them. Okay, that, of course, in religion, they always encounter that problem. And there are different debates as to how to do that. Now, in the GR is an infrared classical continuum limit. I think most people can agree to that. And if you assume some candidate theory, okay, which you believe are the theories governing the basic constituents, you still need to work out these limits. For example, string theory, they have great insight, right, gained great insight into relation of space-time and gauge theories, but still have difficulty producing space-time itself, not to mention, of course, the lack of diffeomorphism invariant formulation. For loop quantum gravity, I don't need to say anything here, but one issue is how to recover the semi-classical limit. Okay, I want to go home. Okay, this is home. This is something that we know, and whoever thinks that they have the truth would still need to relate that truth to the mundane creatures that live in low energy. You know, I mean it. I mean, this is what we are faced with. The universe has to be cold enough for people like us to appear, and so we have to sort of work a little bit harder to try to find out what's up there. Of course, in physics, we need both of them. Okay, we work our way very hard from bottom up. Okay, trying to look for subtle discrepancies, inconsistencies. But then you also need people to say, well, here's the quark model, okay? Work it out, okay, and then you can find it in the lab. So we really need both ways going back and forth. And I think now, compared to 20 years ago, it's really getting better in the sense that both group of people know that they need each other in order to get the truth in lowercase. Now, happy or not so happy situations. As I said, if we're confronted with this unfortunate situation, we need statistical mechanics, stochastic processes, probability theory. You heard a little bit of that from Raphael in his talk, and certainly Lee and Fortini's group are doing really a fabulous job in combining these concepts with some of the basic structures like braids and loops and knots and so on. Now, if you're blessed with the happy situation, we still need statistical mechanics, even condensed metaphysics, okay? You can say, ah, but don't say yuck, okay? So there are several issues for all top-down models to pay attention to. One is closed-open system, okay? And if you go to a subsystem, I have a couple of slides showing this in more detail later on, then most likely you'll see dissipation coming out and noise, okay? That's where the story begins, the story here. And the low energy behavior, most likely you would need to set it in the framework of effective field theory that John gave a wonderful summary on Monday. And also, as I mentioned, you also need to deal with the decoherence issue. And associated with that is not so simple. You know, you can't just say, I pick a coordinate and this, you know, these off-diagonal elements go to zero. There are a lot of intriguing things associated with it that's related to the microstructure going to the macrostructure issue. And for example, out of these, when you reach the macro level, to begin with, how do you choose the collective variable? I mean, so you're stuck even at step zero. It's not so simple. Usually you're given a model, an open system already, but here we have to be creative in finding out the right collective variable. It's almost like in molecular dynamics, right? I mean, you now have the real theory, Newtonian mechanics, second law, and you have a huge computer with the particles, Avogadro's number of particles going here and there. You have complete control and complete information of the system. But it's still very difficult to answer a simple question like, how hot is this room? Okay? Like, temperature is certainly a derived emergent concept. And so I'm just trying to give some illustration in the degree of complexity involved in these issues. Well, this is pretty much, well, these slides were at least 10 years old. I'm just gradually moving it to PowerPoint. So the issues that I pointed out, micro to macro, okay, what constitutes a stable level? Okay, for example, from atom, you can go up to molecules, you can go down to nucleus. Why? Why at that particular level something becomes simpler? And by what means would the description become simpler? Okay, those are related to the choice of collective variables. And together with it, of course, dynamics and interactions. effective theory, how good is it? Oftentimes it's in between levels of structure that it gets very messy and very difficult to capture. What are the appropriate collective variables at each level, the structure and dynamics, as I just mentioned? On the quantum classical issue, the emergence across the classical domain, in the beginning people said, well, just do it this way, and then later on they find that there's a lot of ambiguity. Decoherence, who chooses the projections and how to choose the projection? Even if you choose the same projection, right, if you keep on repeating it, does it give rise to a stable structure? That's what I refer to here. Or if you change the coarse graining measures slightly, will the outcome be robust, okay, with respect to the choice of coarse graining? Or all these issues, you might overlook it. Well, you might think that it's irrelevant. But when you really look at the problem and trying to go even from micro to a macro, I bet you'll run into these problems very quickly. And this is the list that I just mentioned earlier. Most likely, just like from one level of structure to another, when you traverse it, okay, like at most probably in textbooks, we learn how to calculate helium atoms, okay, after hydrogen atom. After that, it gets too difficult, and then you say it belongs to the chemists, okay? They have to struggle with that, and that's only two atoms or three atoms. When you have many body system in there, usually that's what you encounter going from one structure to another before you reach the level that it can be captured by another set of collective variables, like in molecular dynamics, going to hydrodynamics or thermodynamics. You will encounter strongly correlated systems and so on and so forth. In fact, it's numerous, these examples. If you look at any of your slides that you give, you can pretty much identify all these structures in there. Okay? So before one jumps over and makes some generalization, one really needs to struggle with this because, as I'll show you in the latest slide, it's easy to look at the thermodynamic limit or hydrodynamic limit, okay, because it's many, many, many to one. Okay, they all share the same limit. And that sort of defeats the purpose. If one tries so hard to get the microscopic structure and then jump over and use some rather broad-based sort of statistical argument, it sort of loses the fun of the whole game, right, of trying to identify the traits that you could correlate or how the microscopic structure could have an influence on the macroscopic structure. Okay? That's good enough. So that is from top down. Okay. Now for bottom up, of course, it's almost an impossible job. Okay. That I admit, from the beginning, it's always very difficult because you're dealing with corrupted information. As I said, you're dealing with what's in the garbage can. It's very difficult to reconstruct the whole picture and sort of retrieve the information that's contained in the micro. On the other hand, the example that I just gave you, even if you have complete mastery of all the micro information, it may not help us, those people who live in the hydrodynamic limit, low energy, long wavelength limit. So bottom up, we need to deal with, issues like elementary versus compositeness and basic laws versus effective descriptions. I don't want to belabor further on some of the philosophical underpinnings of these concepts. Well, one word to say is that there's never such a clear distinction between them. When you move from one level to another, what's elementary becomes composite again, and it goes on ad infinitum. That's my view. Now, I just want to, well, with all these words here, don't worry about it, I'll just follow this pointer here. What are the telltale signs, okay, that's left at low energy that could help us to try to reconstruct what could have happened at high energy? I would mention two factors, and I would just focus on one of them, and that is fluctuation and instability. Like in critical phenomena, if you think about what was going on in the 50s in critical dynamics, that was before renormalization group and all these sort of sophisticated techniques, there were, in fact, significant advances when people analyzed the heat capacity at constant volume or the compressibility at constant pressure. What do they give us? They give us when those functions diverge, okay, that when it comes close to the critical point, it actually can give you the critical exponents. Some of the important critical exponents were discovered in the 50s, actually long before the 70s when the RG became popular. I think we are confronted with this situation here, and looking in those directions might be helpful. So bottom up, macro to micro, I would suggest to paying attention to two aspects. I've mentioned noise and fluctuation, and there's also, of course, topological structures, because most likely those are very resilient to evolutionary or environmental changes. It's likely to survive this long sort of coarse-graining history. Now, I should also mention something just to give some hope for people who want to go bottom-up. If you want to go bottom-up and try to get loop quantum gravity, forget it, okay, or string, okay? But there is something that one could get, and one thing is that one could look at the common physical features of macroscopic phenomena. You take Newtonian mechanics, you can go to hydrodynamics, okay? You take electromagnetism, there is also magnetohydrodynamics. Right? People working in plasma physics are very familiar with it. You go to QCD, there's magnetochromal hydrodynamics. Okay? So, without going sort of to the details of the microscopic structures, there are commonalities, common features shared by macroscopic phenomena. Okay? And that's another aspect, sort of the almost orthogonal to this sort of vertical reductionist idea that we're trying to glean through the different microscopic structures what's common in the macroscopic physical structure features. Okay, so it's only by doing so, separating the common features, that you can pinpoint the particulars particular to these three theories, for example. And actually, next to it, there's quantum gravity. What we have, okay, this is really a poor man's way of doing things. The first lesson that Wheeler taught all of his students, give me a poor man's way of understanding it. This is how poor we are. Well, I shouldn't say, in front of general relativity is the greatest theory probably, but climbing up to get the microscopic structure of space-time, that really is just the beginning, right? The starting point. We have those two. In the 70s, we have quantum field theory and curved space-time. In the 80s, by studying the renormalization properties as well as the back reaction, we get semi-classical gravity. So here, the back reaction is of course central importance. And in the 90s, in the next slide, I'll show you that we generalize it to what's called the stochastic gravity. It's actually very simple to understand. From this viewpoint, semi-classical gravity really is just a mean field theory, wherein the expectation value of the energy momentum tensor serves as the source that drives Einstein equation. These are the things that we have to deal with in the 70s. And a very modest bottom-up route, this is really going just a few steps from the classical general relativity to quantum field theory and curved space-time to semi-classical gravity to stochastic gravity. And if you notice here, I don't think I have time to, there are actually more slides later on, so I might as well tell you now. There's an extra piece there, okay? You can't just put in by hand. That's what took us a long time. First of all, we're dealing with, of course, unitary evolution. Okay, in particle physics and in relativity, it's very difficult to even introduce the concept of stochasticity. That much I want you to appreciate, okay? And well, there is actually a rightful place for such a term to be there. And that really is our starting point. This is the mean field, and if you draw the analogy with critical phenomena, the mean field theory was okay. It actually provided a bit of some bits of information for certain systems. But you really need the fluctuation to probe near the critical point, and it's because of this in this context that motivated me in that direction of looking for ways to accommodate or to incorporate fluctuation, okay, in an otherwise completely sort of unitary theory. So the key ingredient in the stochastic theory is noise and fluctuations. The equation, the centerpiece, is what's known as the Einstein-Langevin equation. It's completely covariant, actually, okay? It's not like you put in something by hand, a noise term, and that was what took a little bit of time for us to work out. And as I mentioned, stochasticity, of course, is really the center, centerpiece here, central issue here, I should say. And of course, the backdrop being non-equilibrium statistical mechanics. So, this is sort of a chronology, well, a logbook for basically myself. I say alternative, but then I decided that it maybe just an alternative of one. Maybe I'm the only one that's taking this view, so I shouldn't drag other people along. Condensed matter is, cosmology is condensed matter physics, for example. Lee wrote a beautiful article. Wojtek even suggested some experiment, phase transition and so on. I proposed that view in 88, so it's about 20 years ago now. And one by one, semiclassical, as I just explained, semiclassical gravity is really the mean field. Stochastic gravity provides the fluctuations. And I will view that really as mesoscopic physics. And in fact, it's the whole range from the micro to the macro. In the molecular dynamics analogy is really kinetic theory. So stochastic gravity is really playing the role sort of like kinetic theory. And this is the vein of thought that sort of developed that idea further with the kinetic theory approach to quantum gravity. By quantum gravity, everything here, I mean the microscopic theory of the theory of the microscopic structure of space-time. Okay, and general relativity as hydrodynamics. Of course, I owe that to Sakharov, 1968. But there are actually a lot that needs to be developed in order to make that a more comprehensible sort of idea and a set of tenets to go by. So, for example, take this, stochastic gravity to quantum gravity. The key issue there is how to retrieve quantum coherence information from fluctuations, okay? So it's quite challenging, and in fact, I enjoy doing that sort of thing, just for the purpose of learning non-equilibrium statistical mechanics. And the latest is to view space-time as condensates. It's still a lot of rough edges, of course, but I just find it, maybe it's fun to toy around with some of the ideas here. All right, that's a big introduction, okay? This is the outline of the talk. I've covered the first 2 points. Let me move quickly, okay, to get to non-locality, but I'm quite sure I won't be able to cover them all, so let me just say it here. Micro non-locality, as far as I know, for most of the examples that I've seen, it's just completely different from macro non-locality. So don't worry about it. If you're dealing with a microscopic theory that's non-local, don't just force it onto the macro. I'll come back to that. And then to statistical mechanics, that's something that I know a little bit, and it harks back to the coarse grating and the back reaction. These two are the key processes that one needs to deal with. And from there, you actually see non-locality and stochasticity coming out hand in hand. I know virtually nothing, okay, in how these two issues play out in quantum gravity, because there are as many sort of theories as how you deal with some of these issues. Ways as the ways that you would deal with these issues. So I will come back again to something that I know, and that is in the context of stochastic gravity, you can actually see these two issues playing out real well. I mean, it's first principle derivation, nothing put in by hand, and non-locality in time. I'm restricted just to that aspect because in space-time, there are big problems encountering causality structures and so on and so forth. So I will mention another key issue, which is correlation. So these are the tools that I would rely on in order to sort of scale this mountain, almost impossible mountain. All right, non-locality. Well, in quantum mechanics, let me skip over that. It's a big thing these days, of course, from EPR and Bell's theorem and so on. There's talk, of course, in quantum field theory about the contradiction in the extended in space versus local observables. I think most people would agree that quantum field theory is really a local theory. Space-time, I just mentioned. Non-locality, you really have to be careful whether you're violating the causal structure. Okay? I know of one place where this shows up, non-commutative geometry, and I'm still trying to learn a little bit more in that. As I said, I don't know anything about how this issue fares from quantum gravity. I will show you a couple of slides where we learn, where I learned from Lee and Fortini's papers, and I'll make some comments on that. And finally, of course, in statistical mechanics, that's what, where we really can see some of these, two of these issues coming out, and central to the what's known as emergent phenomena. It looks like everybody's talking about emergence these days. All right, just a very quick example, a familiar example. Let's take molecular dynamics versus hydrodynamics. Okay? Chairman, how much time I've used up? Okay, thank you. Now, if we start out with individual molecules, those are the variables that we use to describe the dynamics. If we go to hydrodynamics, we're looking at fluid elements governed by Euler's equation or the Navier-Stokes equation, if you include dissipation, vorticity, and all that, okay, with the transport coefficient, transport functions in there. So you can see the parity. Well, the common here is that the time scale to begin with, the dynamic time scale of molecular motion is much, much, I should say, if it's time, is much shorter than, of course, diffusion time. Right? It takes a long time for some perfume molecule from here to over, get to the other side of the room. And even in length scale, there are multiple scales appearing, as in turbulence. Now, look at turbulence. I mean, we all know the microscopic theory. But even today, we don't have a satisfactory theory of turbulence. That's because there's too many scales involved in there. Okay, this is another warning, sort of an example of what I said earlier. This is a completely, known theory, Newtonian mechanics. Scales can also change drastically at the critical point. So, if you assume this touches on the group running, for example. Usually if you run from the ultraviolet to the infrared, the convenient cases assume there's a tacit assumption behind it, and that is the running is homogeneous. Whether that is doable really depends a lot on the system, and we know that systems belong to different universality classes really can have very different ways of running in there. So I'm issuing sort of warnings to myself when I try to sort of go down this path. Now, molecular to hydrodynamics are probably the easiest emergent phenomenon. They're more involved macroscopic emergent phenomena, which cannot be predicted. I just want to make this comment here pertaining emergent phenomena, okay, or not so easily deductible. Condensed metaphysicists all point to quantum Hall effect, okay? By that, I don't mean that, and they don't mean that, you cannot sit down with the microscopic theory and deduce quantum Hall effect. What they mean is that without somebody, experimentalist, coming into your office and tell you that there are these crazy fractional, charges showing up and so on and so forth, the theorists would never have guessed to look in that direction. So here's another example that don't belittle whatever is showing up at the macroscopic level. You might even see a completely different world from the micro, okay? And so I'm summarizing those in these two statements. Macro states are not just superpositions of micro states. I've seen statements like that creeping up in papers a lot. And emergence is more than just repetitive coarse graining. This, refers back to something I mentioned 5 minutes ago, that even in coarse graining, there's really a whole theory by itself. We really have to be careful about that. So stating this outwardly, micro-locality is different from macro-locality. Let me just give you one example. It's really just mundane and superficial to some of you, maybe. A molecule, okay, will collide with many others at very high speed for a long time before reaching a macroscopic observer over there, okay? From here to there, any molecule would have to take a long time before this molecule really goes from this point A to point B, as measured by a macroscopic observer, okay? That molecules' apparent locality with respect to other molecules arriving at about the same time in a gas element. So now I am at the macro level. I take the fluid element, this time, in this case, gas element. The molecules that's in this gas element really comes from everywhere in the room, okay, at that particular instance, okay. So what I regard as locality, and in fact I could evolve that, you know, with Euler's equation, okay, with the collective variables, has nothing to do with the life history of that particular molecule, okay. And that by itself is not local, you know, it's completely. So although each collision is local, okay, when viewed at a collective level, each particle has a highly non-local history. Okay, that, of course, by saying that, it really, I have to qualify that. It's only for chaotic system that you will see that. If you're dealing with Lasov dynamics, okay, like with long-range electromagnetic potential, well, you can get by and see each other at a distance, and that turns the problem into a local sort of interaction, and surely so. You can even invoke a beam field theory to describe Lasov dynamics, which is collisionless Boltzmann, okay? So, you see, the smoothness and continuity of the fluid element's movement to a macroscopic observer described by the Navier-Stokes equation with diffusion and all the transport functions in there really belie the stochastic and non-local nature of molecular collisions. Okay? It's only when you get to the micro level that some of these concepts would become to make sense. When you're really following that molecule, it doesn't make sense anymore. What do you mean I'm stochastic? I know my trajectory, even though I'm bumping here and there. It's still a continuum, okay? I have my own history. So even with these simple examples, we can see, this simple example is too simple because you can actually deduce the macro time scale from the micro. Not to mention many other systems which are not, you know, which you cannot do such a thing. Similar situation in quantum gravity, one could say, take, for example, a wave state. I still remember telling us it's really an exciting thing because that would enable one to connect from the micro to the macro. But I'm trying to point out here that the concept of quantum threats weaved into a fabric of classical space-time already tacitly assumes a particularly simple kind of micro-macro transition. Okay? Where there's a simple correspondence or even equivalence between locality at the micro and the macro level. Now, this, in the next slide, I'll show you that. Well, it was pointed out, I'm sure the leaders, you know, in this field are keenly aware of these things. I'm just drawing this as an example. Now, this is not the case for even simple examples of emergence like molecular to hydrodynamics, that there's no equivalence between the micro and the macro level of locality. And if we think about the sense of locality at the level of M theory for string theory, or synthesis for dynamical triangulation, versus the locality in our macroscopic space-time, you'll also see the big discrepancy. Okay? So that's, of course, at the heart of emergence, the construction of collective variables, and all the things that I've mentioned in the first part of the talk. Now, let's focus a little bit, you know, further in one of these examples. Non-local weave states really leaves their marks on the fabric of space-time. So Bambelli, of course, you know a lot more than I do. And in Fortini and Lee's paper, recent paper, they pointed out that most weave states, including the Bombelli, which of course is a very, very careful, creative way of introducing combinatorics method to weave these things into a space-time, including those, assume that these weave states all satisfy an unstated condition of locality, which is that the edges connecting two nodes of metric distance are of the Planck length, okay? But there are plenty of weave states which do not specify this condition. This was pointed out by in this paper. And so the existence of non-local weave states, of course, if you take that philosophy, that viewpoint that I sort of discussed in the first 20 minutes, is no surprise whatsoever, okay? The question is, how does one weave from these non-local microstates a fabric, the manifold, with a familiar macroscopic locality, okay? So in that paper, Fortini and Lee provided us an answer, saying that disordered locality can be tolerated because they are sort of sparse and even useful in the production of dark energy. I'm always a little bit more conservative. My attitude is to take this inequivalence of micro and macro local locality seriously and let it live with us for life, okay? We need to depart even radically from familiar concepts in our macro world, okay? And there is new physics to be uncovered. That's the reason why I urge us not to just find a solution and, you know, to make the sort of connection between the micro level and the macro level in this way. A good example, since I've been using molecular dynamics, a good example for my own discovery is that in the last 15 years, there's actually significant progress for people working at the foundation of non-equilibrium thermodynamics, going to chaotic dynamics or dynamical systems, and they've actually come up with some really nice discoveries that some basic laws of non-equilibrium thermodynamics, like the second law, okay, the famous second law, can now be understood or derived from chaotic dynamics. That is important. And I see those as examples wherein we could follow, even no matter how remote it is from space-time, I think the rules governing the micro to the macro or going the reverse direction will be quite similar. So our conception and construct of the macro world may not bear any resemblance to the micro world. Now, as I said, I don't know anything about quantum gravity, so I'm borrowing some insight from the leaders in this field. Let me go back to step Mach, and there's quite a bit that we can learn from it, okay? To begin with, I actually learned these things from Swanzig sitting in his course. If you just take a closed system divided into two subsystems, this is classical, purely just classical, the dynamics of each subsystem obeys second-order ODE, right? But you can always transform this set of coupled equations into an integral differential equation governing only variables A or B, your choice. Already in this integral differential equation, you see non-locality in time. And the reason is very simple, because you are factoring in the full dynamics of subsystem B into your equation. Okay, and so the evolution of subsystem A being influenced by subsystem B certainly has the imprint of the dynamics of subsystem B, and that's why you have different timescales and hence non-locality in time, non-Markovian behavior, or simply put, memory. Okay, and notice that back reaction is the source of non-locality in time. If you don't have back reaction, well, you just evolve in the ordinary ODE, okay, comfortably. So the memory is deeply sort of entrenched with back reaction. Now comes coarse graining. If the subsystem B has many degrees of freedom, from this point we call it the environment, and the coarse graining of subsystem B can begin, you know, it's at that point that you decide to throw away some information in this subsystem B with many degrees of freedom, okay? Then we can begin to talk in terms of mean field and fluctuations, okay? Not before that. And in so doing, it would render the combined system an open system. Information is lost by choice. So a lot depends on how you introduce the coarse graining. It is, as I just said, the coarse graining and the coarse-grained environment certainly acts on the system, and the back reaction is what brings forth non-local dissipation and at the same time colored noise. Okay? So you can see non-locality and stochasticity really come in hand. This is from a slide, and I hope it could illustrate what I just said, even in introducing some technical formalism in here. So you start with a quantum closed system, break it into two subsystems, still closed. If it has many degrees of freedom, call it the environment, okay? At this point, you introduce coarse graining. Then you're turning an environment, right? And the effect of environment on the system, you're turning the system, original subsystem A, into an open system. And also an effective theory, and from that point it actually follows the effective dynamics, okay? It's at this point that it becomes non-unitary, dissipative, irreversible. The influence functional is a very good formalism, certainly for us, to follow this development, and it's equivalent to the coarse-grained, closed-time path, coarse-grained effective action, okay? So I promise you there won't be too much mathematics, but I just want to point out that in there you can see the noise kernel, N, and the dissipation kernel. So dissipation and fluctuation really come out from the same source. It really comes from, the unitarity in the closed system is what gives you the relationship between these two. I also want to point out that it's through the noise that the original quantum system becomes classical. Okay? So there is a quantum to classical transition here, and you can also look at the left side and the right side. Usually, for a particle physicist using quantum field theory, you don't want to see dissipation or noise from there. But in fact, this formulation contains renormalization in the treatment of some of these contributions from higher modes. So in fact, this is really an incorporation of non-equilibrium statistical mechanics ideas into quantum field theory. And from there, it leads to a master equation, Fock-Planck equation, Langevin equation, any one of these three, what's known as stochastic. And the center of mass variable actually obeys the Langevin equation, and you can see how the quantum classical transition goes about. So let me skip over all these things and go to the last part and conclude. The noise and dissipation kernel from a quantum Brownian motion, you can see them explicitly from first principle. You can do the same thing with molecular dynamics, as I refer to, is a closed system, but because we cannot have the means to access all the higher order correlation functions, if you are dealing with just one particle or two particle distribution function, you are effectively dealing with an open system. And the non-locality in this case resides in the higher order correlation functions, and it manifests again as non-local dissipation and color noise. So these two paradigms, one Langevin, the other Boltzmann from non-equilibrium statistical mechanics, indicate this very clearly. In fact, there's also noise associated with Boltzmann equation, the noise coming from coarse grain in the higher order correlation functions. If you go back to the derivation of the Boltzmann equation, he's very clever in saying that the two-point function can now be treated as the product of two one-point functions by virtue of the molecular chaos assumption. And the rest of that actually resides in noise. So here is again the non-local noise inducing, coming hand in hand with the dissipation. This is the, sort of the, the theme for this part of the talk. Now, let me just go to the end here. The semi-classical gravity theory I mentioned to you is the mean field. Another important, and you can see that from the Bragg reaction, this is one of the early calculations in isotropy damping, that you can see the dissipation kernel is non-local. Okay? It's the same way, the argument between two subsystems after coarse graining one, the Bragg reaction induces dissipation in the open system. Another key is correlation, okay? And the correlation function measures non-locality and can be related to fluctuations. I just want to mention this, highlight that. And from, of course, the fluctuation, as I mentioned also, this is the theory that we've been relying on, which accommodates the fluctuation for us to look at the effect of fluctuation to go from bottom up. The noise kernel is the centerpiece in there. It's really just the expectation value of the two-point function of the stress energy tensor. It's like in condensed metaphysics, it's like the current-current correlation function. And since mentioning that, let me jump to the very last slide before the conclusion. Okay, I mentioned this already, the kinetic theory approach. So two key ideas was fluctuation. The other is correlation. And I mentioned you can try to climb up this correlation ladder to look for the microscopic structure. The other one is by fluctuation. And I think even at this level, there might be some universality properties, even at the level of Minkowski spacetime. If you look hard enough at the fluctuations, the two-point function for the stress energy tensor could indicate some universality, similar to, I got that inspiration by looking at the what's known as the universal conductance fluctuation. Okay, so these are places that I think could enable us to start looking at the crack of space-time structure through its fluctuations, and hopefully decipher some of the microscopic features associated with it. So this is the summary and task. Non-locality at one level could be locality at another level. They could be completely different. The challenge is, how are they connected? Okay, I attended a couple of the parallel session talks, and no matter what you're doing with the braided group and all that, probably that issue will arise at some point, somewhere. I mentioned non-locality and stochasticity and statistical mechanics. And then in quantum gravity, and certainly from examples of the low-lying theory like stochastic gravity, we see these features coming out not by hand, and in fact very naturally. So my bet is that you would encounter that when you try hard enough to sort of go to the intermediate level, be it going from micro up or from macro down. I should say macro up, bottom up, or the micro down, okay? And correlation is another angle towards non-locality and stochasticity. Strongly interacting and correlated system, most likely we will encounter. I mentioned that already as a macroscopic space-time physics, using correlation hierarchy ideas borrowed from kinetic theory. And finally, okay, even after we've learned all these tools, I'm leaving these two, of course, which should be the paramount importance for this community here, the issue of time, the Muslim invariance, and so on and so forth. As I said, we'll try to learn the commonalities so that we can question them out, and hopefully that could help us already in determining what kind of meaningful questions to ask. And then, of course, finally, we really have to deal with those issues. Thank you. You have a mic for Carlo? It works.
As you said, this is a provocative and thought-provoking talk.
That's the purpose of this talk, in fact, yeah. Please, yeah.
And just to ask from you, you remind me of James Perlmutter. But not the good one, the bad one.
The bad one? Yeah. The bad side of him, or what?
When he wrote Matter, this is just one example.
I have to come closer to hear you.
Yeah, sorry.
It's okay, yeah.
When you wrote Matter equations, which then proved the infinite factor, one of the first things he thought is that these are obviously sort of effective large distance thermodynamical equations, because obviously there are some micro degrees of freedom down there, because we actually know what reality is.
Yeah.
There should be some. And in fact, he was also one founder of kinetic theories, and was particularly inspired by that.
From Maxwell Boltzmann, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He put a lot of energy into finding something that was badly off track with respect to it. Now, this has happened often and often. In fact, from the very beginning, when Newton wrote the gravitational, universal gravitation, a lot of people, including himself, tried sort of to figure out how it could be derived from some flux of particles that
go away. Yeah.
But the genius of Newton was to close it to Kepler's hypothesis and theory, saying, well, look, this is how it works. And in fact, if you look at the world this way, you're not losing, you're gaining. You're learning some new way of thinking. I'll stop in the middle.
No, I enjoy that.
When at the beginning of the 20th century, Einstein, especially, in fact, one of the main contributions was that this game of trying to understand the actual micro degrees of freedom underlying the atomizers was still very active. In particular, because of apparent contradiction with relativity of velocity that was being confirmed.
The ether and other.
So Lorentz and Poincaré, a lot of people thinking, well, let's try to figure out some microscopic dynamic down here. Mm-hmm. Now again, the genius of Einstein was, no, let's take seriously a theory that works and use it as telling us a new guidance of how to think the world.
Mm-hmm.
Not trying to reproduce it thinking that this sort of effective theory is over here. But the introduction of fields, it's fundamental to new thinking. Now,
we had a good discussion at Paris on that, yeah.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. But look, generativity could be an effective large distance aerodynamic theory or something underlying. Seems to me it could be extremely dangerous because it forbids us from seeing what generativity is telling. Look, stop thinking that way. There's a new way of thinking. This is generativity. Seriously, don't discard the message of it trying to interpret.
Oh, we take it seriously at the classical level. Yeah, I think we all do. It's only when we encounter difficulties in quantizing it that prompted us to think in some other ways. I mean, everything you said is, you know, I accept. Yeah. But one thing I don't accept is that I'm confusing the issue. Okay. As I said from the beginning, that's why I have to prepare the apologies. Okay. For people who think that they have the truth, I really applaud it. I sincerely mean it. Okay. You can see from our discussions in the last 20 years. Yeah. And of course, you need to come down. That is work, you know, from the micro level and tell us, you know, how it compares with, you know, the general relativity theory, right? And quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, right? But in the meantime, I think, it would be helpful, you know, and healthy, actually, to look both ways. That's why I said also, the supermechanics, I'm quite sure you need from micro to macro. Okay? I think what you're referring to is really the quantization of general relativity. That might give us the truth. I don't deny it, right? We can see from many talks here, right? But then the truth, as we see it at low energy, needs to be, you know, obtained from the microscopic theory. That's all I was saying, yeah. And for people who don't believe in that, then they are finding trouble for themselves. I agree, yes. Yeah.
So this is fascinating.
Fascinating.